do not allow themselves to become despondent. This is an important quality of Basiji culture. Despair has no meaning for someone who is part of the Basiji. Praise God, we have millions of official Basiji forces and millions more who are unofficial volunteers. That is, there are the young people in mosques, universities, associations, schools and other places who do the same things as the Basiji and are in fact Basijis, but they're not official members of the Basiji organisation. Alongside the Basiji phenomena in our country, we have the Basiji in the Muslim world. There are millions of Basijis in the Islamic world. They are Basiji who do not understand our language, nor do we understand their language, but we share the same heartfelt values. These are also the blessings of the Basiji. In further remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "This is Imam Khomeini's legacy, which remains today, and God willing, it will continue to be with us tomorrow, and the country will see its fruits." Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, introduced the Basiji as a manifestation of the Shajaratul Tayyiba, or the good tree, which has also been mentioned in the Holy Quran. Have you seen how Allah has drawn a parable? A good principle is like a good tree. Its roots are steady and its branches are in the sky. It gives its fruit every season by the leave of its Lord. The nature of a good tree is that it produces its sweet fruit and gives results in every season. We already spoke about how the Basiji have the potential to move the country forward. I will now talk about some of the achievements of the Basiji volunteer forces. First of all, the presence of the Basiji in any period indicates that the Islamic revolution is alive. It shows that the revolution is thriving. Much of the dismay of those who are frightened and distressed by the word and the name of the revolution. They do not want the revolution to be mentioned. They express hatred towards the Islamic revolution and they reject it. But the presence of the Basiji volunteer forces shows the revolution is very much alive, it's blossoming, and it's prospering. So one of the fruits of the Basiji presence is that it shows the regeneration and vitality of the Islamic revolution. The second thing is the spirit that I mentioned, the spirit of jihadi work, without expecting anything in return, without wanting to reveal your name, without being pretentious. This will create rapid progress in the country. Work that is done with the intention of impressing others in a pretentious manner has no beneficial value. Doing jihadi work without having any expectations will move the country forward. This is another example of the fruits of the Basiji. Third point is the element of spirituality is prominent in all activities that are taken by the Basiji volunteers. And this element of spirituality is very important. Further remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The Basiji hold a very important position in the political geography of the Islamic world, which I need to briefly explain. Of course, intellectuals, clear-sighted individuals, and you young people should focus on and think about these issues. Western colonialism has a certain line of approach towards this special region of ours, the West Asia region, or the region they call the Middle East. Following the two world wars, Western colonialism, Europe first and then the Americans, paid special attention to this region and established a distinct approach towards it. But why? Because it is an important region. The movements of the Western world's industrial wheels is dependent on oil from this region, from the West Asia or Middle East region. The world's main center for oil is here in this region, the region of West Asia. It links the East to the West. It is the region that connects Asia, Europe and Africa. This is the most important issue in terms of its strategic position." In further remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution commented on recent rioting in Iran and negotiations with the United States. The leader said, "Some people claim they understand politics, but it's really upsetting when you see their analysis in newspapers and in some sections of the social media. They say that in order to put an end to the rioting that has been taking place in this country for the past few weeks, you need to solve your problems with the United States first." Now, this is said by those who claim to know about politics and world affairs. They certainly state that you need to solve your problems with America, or they say you should listen to the voice of the people. I have seen these two comments in their writings. Solve your problems with the United States and listen to the voice of the people. But how can the problem with the United States be solved? This is the real question, and it is a very serious question. We do not want to argue with each other. We are asking a question. How can the problem with the United States be solved? Will the problem be solved by sitting down and negotiating and getting a promise from them? If we sit down and negotiate with the United States and make them commit to doing this or that, will the problem be solved? In further remarks, the leader said, "They tell us to stop our nuclear activities. They start by telling us to stop 20% uranium enrichment. Then they tell us to stop 5% uranium enrichment. Next, they tell us to completely halt all kinds of nuclear activities. Then, they will tell us to change the constitution of our country and to remove the Guardian Council. The US is demanding payoffs. If you want to fix your problem with the United States, you must continually surrender to US demands. This is what the Americans really want. Imprison yourself behind your borders, disarm yourselves and shut down your defense industries. What kind of proud, devoted Iranian is willing to give in to those demands?" In concluding remarks, the leader wished success and strength for all members of the Basij volunteer forces, saying, "The final victory would be ours."
Economic Divide.
It's a concept that has been around for a while, and you probably take it into account when you buy a product by looking for the label, for example, or the color. It's called greenwashing. What is it? Well, that's what we're here to tell you. For even though companies are supposed to comply with green energy commitments, which they use to advertise their products, they're guilty of lying about it. Some of the headlines coming up in this program. First, greenwashing as a whole. What is it? Well, in one sense, marketing as environmentally friendly, but it's also said to be a ploy to make more profits. In essence, a deceitful marketing gimmick is how some describe it. Next up, we will take a look at something that happened recently by the name of the COP27 climate conference. Banks and corporations are said to be lying about their commitments, pledges of net zero emissions, for example, again being false. Then the big question of accountability. Does the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, actually have a game plan? And then greenwashing reality. That's right, scamming the hopelessly naive. Governments are also guilty of this. Scamming taxpayers under the guise of going green.
As the world continues to suffer from a climate crisis in all corners of the globe, concerns are rising over what critics have called greenwashing. Concept refers to a practice through which false information or misleading impression is conveyed about the environment friendliness of a company's products. Greenwashing involves making an unsubstantiated claim to deceive consumers into believing that a company's products are environmentally friendly. The concern was recently raised by the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the climate change conference in Egypt.
And today's crisis cannot be an excuse for backsliding or greenwashing. If anything, they are a reason for greater urgency, stronger action, and effective accountability.
Experts believe actors cannot claim to be net zero and at the same time continue to invest in new fossil fuel supply or any kind of environmentally destructive activities. They also cannot claim to be net zero while they are lobbying activities against climate change or just report on one part of their business's assets while hiding the rest. The practice is even more dangerous at state levels. Recently, it was announced that over $340 billion per year by 2030 is needed to prevent Earth's temperature from increasing by 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. For governments and their affiliated businesses, the large amount of money is viewed as a potential source to tap into, while at the same time, they portray themselves as environmentally friendly actors.
When it comes to social media posts, many of the items that we looked at concerned climate change. Of course, greenwashing was mixed in with some of the online media posts, but it's incredible how people feel about this in terms of the focus being that there's not enough being done to actually enforce it. And in other words, for companies to actually comply with the commitment, especially when it comes to the labeling of the packages that is being sold to consumers. All right, first up, this is our first post. The downgrades of ESG funds come as the environmental, social, and governance sector faces growing criticism and accusations of greenwashing, which have prompted investigations by regulators and law enforcement in the U.S. and in Germany. Now, we want to step further, take a look at this and see what it has to say. It said European asset managers are blaming regulatory confusion, the keyword confusion, for downgrade of ESG funds, where Europe's top asset managers are downgrading their ESG funds holdings, in which it's comprised of tens of billions of dollars of client money that had been badged at the highest level of sustainability, but which have come under increasing regulatory scrutiny. The downgrades come as the environmental, social, and governance sector faces growing criticism and accusations of greenwashing, what we just said, and of course that has prompted investigations by regulators and law enforcement in the U.S. and Germany. Have to wait and see what pans out or what comes out of those investigations. Next post, we don't get much water out here. This particular post, we took a look because it was interesting in terms of climate crisis as a whole. This says we don't get much water out here. They're going to pollute it. Duranda Shoshone tribe making that claim. 1.7 billion gallons of water depletion per year is planned at the Thacker Pass lithium mine. Next up, just like fossil fuel lobbyists, animal agriculture lobbyists were also present at the COP27 energy that happened that also involved greenwashing, the effects of the meat dairy on the planet. Science is very clear. We need to end animal agriculture and shift to a plant-based food system in order to mitigate the climate crisis. All right, those were some of the posts. Sorry, we picked a couple over there where it kind of swayed a little bit away from greenwashing, but still was under the umbrella of the climate crisis. Let me introduce our guest for this segment of the Q&A. Joining us first is Julia Giordano. She is the ECCO Head of International Programs. ECCO is an Italian climate change think tank based in Italy. Julia Giordano, welcome to Economic Divide. Please explain to us first what greenwashing actually is. From what we understand is when an organization spends more time and money basically on marketing itself as being quote, unquote, environmentally friendly than actually minimizing its environmental impact. I mean, it sounds like a deceitful gimmick. What are the gains for companies by doing this? And why not just actually go and do it, be environmentally friendly?
Okay, so, yeah, first of all, your definition is pretty much correct. I would say is the attempt to present a product or a strategy as environmentally friendly when it in reality is not. And it's done through, as you said, marketing and communication strategies, but can also be done through other tools, other mechanisms, shortcuts, for example, to present a product, to present something as green, as environmentally friendly, when it's not. The reason is to preserve the status quo, to protect profits, in the kind of like assumption that moving forward towards a more sustainable economy would not be beneficial, which is a big mistake. The reality is that the transition towards, for example, a fossil fuel economy could present enormous opportunities for a sustainable, just, and greater development for many countries.
All right, Joellen Lewis-Russell is an American oceanographer and climate scientist who joins us now. Joellen Russell, welcome. Are there enough laws out there to actually enforce these green commitments or for companies to adhere to these claims that they use, that there's green energy in their production process, do you think?
The more the better. But I also worry a little bit that we're putting a lot of emphasis on what we call adaptation, basically just getting used to being able to handle the very high heat, the very large floods, the coastal inundation, you know, our incredible droughts out here in the West and the wildfires and the emissions. But it would be as a scientist, I'm more interested because I am robot floats and measuring how much carbon's going into the ocean, et cetera. I'm more interested in mitigation.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of the program where we take a look at economic news from around the world. First up, we're going to take a look at Germany and how it's doing overall. It's obviously experiencing lots of problems, and it's affecting living standards. The country's living standards, according to this piece of news, could collapse. This actually was something that a government politician said, that the EU's biggest economy could soon become CO2 neutral, but poor. That's according to a politician by the name of Henning Hohne. He said people need to realize the seriousness of the situation, noting that a number of companies from Lanxess to BASF are ready to invest anywhere but Germany. Of course, that has to deal with the rising energy costs in that country. Next up, let's take a look at cryptocurrencies and see how they're doing. Well, crypto collapse is continuing. This headline read, Betrayed, FTX meltdown signals end to crypto's Wild West days. Cryptocurrency exchange's spectacular collapse has spurred government scrutiny and has called for greater regulation. Now, just to put things in perspective, crypto peaked in November 2021. At that point, investors lost more than $2 trillion up to this point. That's $2 trillion with a T. Okay? All right. This particular topic is very interesting. It's about meatless products. And it says that maybe times are ending for the meatless movement. Beyond Meat, which is a company that produces this, is struggling, and the plant-based meat industry is worrying. A few years ago, business was booming. That growth has slowed, with some wondering if the number of consumers has reached its limit. Now, the debate is whether Beyond Meat's struggles are specific to the company or is it a harbinger of deeper issues in the plant-based meat industry overall. Next up, let's take a look at gold, in particular, China's gold reserves. China has secretly been hoarding gold. Central banks across the world have actually stepped up their gold purchases after Russia's overseas assets were frozen under sanctions this year. Now, the gold buying frenzy comes as part of fresh attempts by central banks who want to protect their assets by reducing their exposure to the U.S. dollar. And finally, since we're in the World Cup fever, this particular piece of news caught our attention. It's about FIFA and its earnings. FIFA World Cup revenue was up by more than $1 billion. That's right, after taking the tournament to Qatar. Now, the sponsorship was boosted by deals with Qatari companies. Costs were reduced by effectively holding World Cup in one city, so that's the key. Then the earnings from this World Cup cycle are, as a result, $1 billion more than those generated from the 2018 tournament that was held in Russia. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The in-depth section is upon us. Being an ecologically conscious consumer, or green consumer in short, is tough. It feels like there is an endless list of brands that we actually need to avoid. In order to identify misleading ads, the following we have termed the six sins of green washing. All right, first one is called hidden trade-offs. Perhaps the most famous example of this category is organic farming. Organic food is marketed as better for the environment because it eliminates the use of synthetic items, things like pesticides or fertilizers or antibiotics. But the manufacturing process, well, that emits carbon dioxide. That is why it's called the hidden trade-off. Sin number two is called no proof. What does that mean? Well, environmental claims need to be backed by certification and science. Businesses can claim their products are, quote, emissions-free or all-natural without the proof. Many companies are reluctant to publicize their manufacturing process, but when they are making definitive environmental claims, they need to show their work. That's what that means. On to sin number three. This one is pretty obvious about what it means, vagueness, and those are some of the labels there. Terms like green or environmentally friendly or sustainable don't really mean anything. While they imply some environmental benefits, there's no strict standard for what they require. When companies advertise a green product but don't clarify what that means, it's a form of greenwashing. Sin number four, irrelevance. Some environmental claims may be true, but simply don't matter. For example, the sin of irrelevance is aimed at products that advertise an obvious environmental feature. One good example is what's called CFC-free products. CFC are the gases used for various purposes like in solvents or refrigerants or aerosol sprays. They have been banned for over 30 years, but you still see the products advertising that they are CFC-free. Sin number five, the lesser of two evils. Some product categories are just inherently hard on the environment. For example, an SUV may advertise as having 5% lower emissions. Yes, it is better than some alternatives, but that still doesn't make it environmentally friendly. The same goes for gasolines that make such claims. And finally, sin number six, fibbing or lying in short. Here, we're talking about just straight up lying. That's right. A company advertising its products are additive free or contains no harmful chemicals, and it is simply not true. Relatively speaking, this form of greenwashing is fairly rare, according to stats, although that's hard to believe. Manufacturers are more likely to mislead rather than lie. You be the judge on that. Now, in terms of sins by category, let's take a look at the breakdown in terms of the percentages. The sin of hidden trade-off coming in at number one, followed by the sin of no proof at number two. The thing that is ironic is that the sin of fibbing or lying that I just mentioned is in last place. We ask, aren't all of these sins an act of lying? And finally, don't have to go very far to actually find out if the companies are lying. We went straight to the top to get information on that, to the company CEOs. And in a survey that was published of over 1,400 executives across different industries around the world, 58% of the CEOs admitted that their companies were guilty of greenwashing. Among the leaders in the U.S., that figure rose to 68%. Okay, let's bring back our guests to see what they think. Julia Giordano is ECCO Head of International Programs. ECCO, again, a reminder, is an Italian climate change think tank who rejoins us. Julia Giordano, welcome back. You are looking at the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres in the COP27 Climate Change Summit or Conference. What he said, banks and corporations making pledges of net zero emissions are taking the public for a ride. If everybody knows that, why hasn't the UN as an organization acted on that or not worked with governments to implicate organizations who are guilty of this?
So this is actually what Guterres has been asking, and hopefully this is what will happen. So last year Guterres highlighted the risks of greenwashing, the risks that many entities can, as I said before, present something as green, as environmentally, as climate aligned, when it's not. So big corporations, financial institutions, and all kind of like non-state actors. So it called for the creation of a committee, of a group of experts, to analyze the situation and present recommendations to such actors on what should be done in order to be defined in line, aligned with the climate objectives. So we are talking about, you know, the alignment to the Paris objective of keeping global warming under 1.5, which is the limit that if we go over, we have extremely catastrophic consequences for the planet.
All right, Joellen Lewis-Russell rejoins us, an American oceanographer and climate scientist. Joellen Russell, what is the story behind rich people actually admitting that they're or emitting more greenhouse gas emissions than people who are either underprivileged or poor? I mean, is that actually something that's true?
Preventing harm to well-served and rich communities as well as underserved communities. There's no way for a rich person to turn down the sun on super hot days so that their kids can play outdoors. You know, as well as not being able to go in for AC if you're in an underserved community or can't afford air conditioning. These are super important that we address both sides, adaptation and mitigation. And I am pro basically any policy that helps get us there, because like I mentioned, the carbon dioxide hangs out for an incredibly long time, long, long past when we will be here, and the harms are accelerating.
All right. That was Joellen Russell there. It's interesting, though, when you think about it, that rich people actually emit more, I guess, CO2 in a sense, and then hence contribute to climate change in that respect. Oxfam came up with a real interesting study on that. Jody Grage rejoins us now. Jody Grage, a member of the Green Party over at the U.S. Jody Grage, welcome back. Greenwashing, just another way of scamming the hopelessly naive is how it's been described. And it's also been said that governments actually are very guilty of that, who have managed to basically relieve taxpayers of these countless of billions to fill slush funds, as it is said, under the guise of saving the world. Is this an accurate view on this, do you think?
Yes, I do. I don't know what it will take before corporations and governments realize that people are not, that we know it's not working. There may have to be a worldwide strike. I don't know, but obviously, reality itself is not enough to make corporations and governments do what they need to do. And part of the problem is that the poorest people with the fewest resources are the most affected.
It's been argued that greenwashing is just another way of scamming the hopelessly naive. For example, using a green pretext to protect U.S. economic interests, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden recently announced that it is launching Inflation Reduction Act. Biden's move is conveniently framed as a green energy initiative.
To a groundbreaking CHIPS and Science law that's going to ensure that technologies and jobs of the future are made here in America. In America. And all this progress is part of our vision and plan and determined effort to get the job done for the American people.
It offers U.S. consumers tax incentives to buy American electric cars with batteries that have at least 40% of components from the U.S. or a country with which it has free trade. This is clearly an attempt by the U.S. administration to seize concerns about global climate crisis to protect the interests of U.S. businesses. But the move has triggered an angry response from the U.S.'s European allies, including France and Germany, who've accused Washington of using green strategy as a tool to protect its own interests. There are now calls within the EU saying that greenwashing of the protectionism scam is something that the EU state should be copying. It is now feared that it's only a matter of time before a Western government would use an environmentally pretext for self-serving economic reasons.
We have already explained to you what greenwashing is, but what we didn't tell you is that this is not a new phenomenon and has been going on for quite some time, even decades, especially in the US. During the 1960s, the contemporary environmental movement began to gain steam. The airwaves, newspapers, and magazines began to fill with newly greened corporate images. In the year 1969, public utilities spent more than $300 million on advertising. That was more than 8 times what they spent on the anti-pollution research they were touting in their ads. Then came the 80s and 90s, where greenwash ads increased and became more sophisticated. This was especially evident in the 1990 on the 20th anniversary of Earth Day. 1/4 of all new household products that came onto the market in the US around the time of Earth Day 20 advertised themselves as recyclable, biodegradable, ozone-friendly, or compostable. In the early 1990s, one poll found that 77% of Americans said that a corporation's environmental reputation affected what they bought. The 21st century saw big oil conglomerates capitalizing on the green agenda, which included names like BP and Shell. BP, the world's second largest oil company and one of the world's largest corporations, advertised its new identity as a leader in moving the world beyond petroleum. Yet, it has spent $5 billion over 5 years for oil exploration in Alaska alone. And finally, there are other forms of greenwash that carry the same misleading approach with the ultimate goal of attracting customers. Blue wash refers to corporations that wrap themselves in the blue flag of the United Nations in order to associate themselves with UN themes of human rights, labor rights, and environmental protection. And sweat wash, associated with child labor and sweatshop abuses, companies notorious for the use of sweatshops, used to divert attention from their factories' practices. Example include Nike, Reebok, and other major clothing and fashion brands, a practice which is continued till this day. That's the end of this part of the program.
This program covered a topic which companies have used to sell their products to environmentally friendly consumers or shoppers or buyers who care about the climate change. And that's really a good incentive. While many companies, not all, however, are guilty of not doing that, here's another thought. Green energy right now, when there's an energy shortage, do you think that it makes sense? It should. Don't get me wrong, but it's really just a myth. The world is facing an energy crisis like never before. I mean, electric cars? Who's got the money to pay for the electric bills? Meanwhile, our Earth, us, me and you, continue to gasp for clean air. That does for this edition of the program. Great, again, to have you with us. From Mikko Vetälä and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand. In the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. A box of Iranian tea?
Yes, here you are.
Thank you.
Are you going to make a new trip?
Yes, to the city of Maku. I'm going to visit Bahçecuk Palace.
Must be a spectacular sight to visit.
It is. Bahçecuk Palace is a palace located between the border towns of Maku and Bazargan in West Azerbaijan province, northwestern Iran. It is situated in a vast garden covering about 11 hectares. This palace was built at the end of Qajar dynasty under the orders of Iqbal Sultan Makui, one of the commanders of Muzaffar-e-Din Shah. Currently, the palace is a museum, also known as Kakh Muzeye Maku. The palace consists of two floors that are made up of numerous halls and chambers, most of them beautifully decorated with paintings, mirrorwork, and plaster moldings. Adding to its beauty is the facade, which contains banisters and statues made of plaster. Inside the palace, you will also see gorgeous curtains, colored windows, beautiful super soft beds, as well as impressive chandeliers. Fireplaces are also terrifically adorned in flowers. The iconic landmark in West Azerbaijan province joined Iran's National Heritage List in 1996. Well, I am now in the area of the palace. You know what? I came a long way to get here, but it's worth visiting. It's a big land. I think it could take about 3 hours to visit the whole place. Wow, it's a symmetrical looking building. It's really gorgeous. I wish you were here to see this wonderful palace. Actually, it's a combination of Iranian and Western architecture. Let me get closer to the building. Oh, look! Here is a dusty carriage. It belongs to Iqbal al-Sultan Makui, one of the commanders of Muzaffaruddin Shah. And over there is a balcony decorated with plasterwork. Wow, it looks very beautiful. It has a set of staircase and colorful bricks. It said Iqbal al-Sultan Makui used to make a speech in this balcony. In an overall look, you can conclude that this building is a very magnificent sight. Those parts with an Iranian architecture are decorated with flower and bush motifs. Okay, I'm still in the garden. Here is very big. Some sections of the garden are separated with cast iron fences. Very beautiful. And here's full of trees. Berry trees? Walnut trees? Almond trees? Cherry trees, apple and apricot trees. Wow, this garden must look very beautiful in spring. In the western part of the garden, there is an oval-shaped pond. The half-paved garden holds a huge pool which feeds the surrounding plants. Very intelligent. Though I can't take my eyes off all these beauties, I have to manage my time and take a visit to the palace. First floor. In this floor, we have a dining room known as the Green Chamber. Wow, look at it. It is said one of the most beautiful parts of the palace is a hall called Hovuzkhane. It is also known as the Hall of Mirrors. Ceremonies were held in this hall. Let me take a look inside. Oh, mesmerizing. Beautiful mirror work on the walls. And a fountain in the middle of the hall. Of course, it attracts every soul. There are two sets of staircases on two sides of the building that reach other chambers. I wish I had time to visit those chambers. These stairs, there are stone statues. And let me tell you something interesting. On the second floor of this building, there are dried flowers inside the wall and inside ancient glass containers like the building itself. The door and double glazed windows, the design on the windows, the wooden edge of the windows and arches are other examples of the beauty and magnificence of this building. Iranian architects are unique in the world.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. Ever since the Industrial Revolution took place and the Europeans started advancing and colonizing other countries, they made the people and the countries of the world get used to the fact that submission and dominance are two inevitable corresponding parts of the world. This means that the world is split into domineering governments and countries and states that can be dominated. This has been the situation, and this domination system has been around for several centuries. Everyone agreed that they should accept the domination of Western powers, even their culture and appellations. Let me say this here. I have said it before. They call our region the Middle East. What does the Middle East even mean? It means that the origin and center of the world is Europe, like the story about Mullah Nasruddin, where they asked him where the center of the world is, and he replied, the place where the nail of my donkey's brains are pounded into the ground. That is the center of the world.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Any region that is far from Europe is called the Far East, because it is far from Europe. Whichever country is close to it, like some North African countries, are considered to be in the Near East. Those that are in the middle of these are known as the Middle East. That is the basis for naming countries by Europe. That is how Westerners were so self-entitled. This is why I insist on not calling the Middle East, but West Asia instead. It is in West Asia, after all. Why should we call it the Middle East? The Islamic Republic was the one who formed the spirit of showing resistance toward the tyranny, power-seeking, and hegemony of the domineering powers. The first person in the world to say neither East nor West was Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh.
I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Russian prisoners of war being executed by Ukrainian soldiers. Multiple videos have been released on Ukrainian Telegram channels. The most recent shows 11 Russian soldiers shot in the head after being detained. While both sides accuse each other of war crimes, Kiev is openly flaunting the crimes committed at the hands of its troops. At a press conference in Lugansk, a Russian soldier, Dmitry, recounts what happened when he was captured on the front line.
They ordered me to lie down, hands behind my back. One of them came up to me and hit my back with the handle of his machine gun. They put a bag on my head and waited for their commanders. In some time, the commander came, took the bag off my head, took me by the throat and started to cut my left hand with a knife. It's still functioning badly. He hit me in the teeth. And afterwards, when they took my machine gun from the vehicle, he asked if it was charged. I answered that it wasn't. He took the cartridge from it, clicked it, pointed at my leg and clicked. Nothing happened, because it was really not charged. He said I was lucky.
On the screen, gruesome images. Russian authorities say they have evidence of torture and a lack of provision of basic medical care, leading to unnecessary death. Now, many of these atrocities are being ignored by media outlets in NATO countries, but Russian journalists, of course, are here, transmitting to a Russian audience, which means large parts of the Russian population are becoming increasingly angry at Ukraine and its NATO backers for atrocities committed against Russian soldiers.
The videos that show Russian prisoners of war being essentially murdered after they've surrendered have been posted by Ukrainian soldiers. These are videos taken by Ukrainian soldiers and then posted on the internet, essentially as a point of pride, in the belief that they are somehow or another frightening or horrifying the Russians, who knows. But I also think there's another sinister dimension to this. I think there's an interest in Ukraine, particularly in Kiev or Kyiv, to ensure that there can be no negotiated settlement between Ukraine and Russia, not so much because of people in Kiev that might be willing to talk, but I think there's growing fear that Washington will ultimately abandon them.
As Russia continues to destroy energy infrastructure and kill Ukrainian soldiers on the front lines in Donbass, and as Ukraine continues to shell civilians in Donetsk and release videos of its war crimes, anger is reaching new heights on both sides, making peace an even more distant prospect. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
The repercussions of the war in Yemen and the difficult economic conditions continue to take a heavy toll on Yemeni patients. Yemen's Ministry of Public Health and Population held a press conference to shed light on the impact of the continued Saudi siege on thalassemia patients. Those suffering from this disease need to get blood transfusions every 3 weeks and must stay on medication for life.
Our main concern is the lack of medicines for thalassemia patients. These medicines, if available, are very expensive, in addition to the lack of necessary medical examinations. We have 20,000 registered patients, while the real numbers are many times higher. These children need special medical care, and we hope that international organizations will stand by them by providing them with what they need.
The Yemeni Health Ministry has recorded nearly 500 deaths due to the lack of only one of the drugs used to treat thalassemia. The ones grappling with the disease seem to be losing hope as time goes by. With their health constantly deteriorating, they are desperately asking for help from international organizations, including the UN.
We suffer a lot from thalassemia. Medicines are not available. We need expensive medicines such as growth injections. We also suffer from a shortage of blood donors, which is what we need continuously.
We greatly need to be provided with important medicines that have not been available since the beginning of the war, such as iron withdrawal treatments. Because our iron level is high due to frequent blood transfusions, which also causes frequent infections.
Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and the ensuing shortages of food and medicine is putting more lives at risk every day. The healthcare system is feeling a massive strain, and the international community has yet to take any definitive steps towards ending the crisis here. Abdulatif Lwashali, Sana'a.
The Italian government has been authorized to send, when it sees fit, military assets, materials and equipment to Ukraine until December 31st next year. The go-ahead has arrived from Italy's lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, which has passed a motion presented by the right-leaning parties backing the government coalition and supported by some opposition groups, including centre-left Democratic Party and centrist Italia Viva Azione. Italy has so far classified the arms it has been sending to Ukraine, but some media have suggested the next package will likely include air and missile defense.
9 months after the start of the conflict, sending weapons to Ukraine is no longer the way to go. We must put peace talks on the table and work all together for a UN-backed peace conference promoted by the EU.
Support for Ukraine has been a contentious issue within the ruling coalition, with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni positioning herself as a staunch supporter of Kyiv. However, her partners Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi, respectively leaders of the League and Forza Italia parties, have been so far much more ambiguous due to their historical ties with Moscow and President Vladimir Putin, the two have repeatedly stressed the urgency of stepping up efforts to promote peace